Welcome to The Catalyst, a platform I created to curate conversations with people who are catalyzing impactful moments within their careers, communities, and countries. As I'm always seeking to interview the most interesting and inspiring people around, I'm happy and honored to host today's guest, Mr. Zembendeya Nagato, on The Catalyst. Welcome to The Catalyst, Mr. Nagato.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Yes, thank you. And as I mentioned, I really am honored to have you on the podcast as you are one of the most influential businessmen on the African continent currently. Not only were you named one of the top 15 CEOs of Africa to watch in 2015, but you also served for years as the managing partner of Ernst & Young Ethiopia, where the incredible work you and the firm spearheaded led you to be recognized as one of the 100 most influential Africans. So it's a real treat to be able to interview you. And before we discuss all the amazing professional adventures you've had, I would love to begin by discussing your journey. How did you find yourself in the influential position you are today?
But again, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure, especially to talk to someone from Harvard. I've had an opportunity over the years to come and speak at the Africa conference at HPS. So again, any connection to Harvard, it's a pleasure. And to respond to your question, influence is a relative thing, right? I mean, if you are president of the United States, you are really, really influential. And then, you know, others in their own fields, from people with day-to-day routines to others. So I want to put influence in context. I will put that the ability to get things done is what I define as being influential, or the ability to make a difference. So in that context, the answer to your question is, you know, I am an African immigrant, came to the United States at a very young age with my family. I'm originally from Ethiopia, so I'm an Ethiopian American. And people my age, of the late 70s and early 80s, we were fleeing Ethiopia, which was a chaotic country, which was governed at that time by a communist regime that was dead set on eliminating the entire generation. So we had no choice but to flee Ethiopia. So we moved to the U.S., educated in the United States. And that's one of the things when people talk about, you know, the value of immigrants to the U.S., I like to use people like us, Africans and others, who've immigrated to the U.S. and we've contributed collectively. We've made a significant, meaningful contribution the United States and beyond. So the influence and whatever success that came subsequently is because the U.S. gave me an opportunity to be educated, to hold, you know, successful professional positions in big firms like the PwC, firms like EY, and obviously the firm that I'm with now, which is a global private equity firm. So it's the opportunity that we were given by the Americans and the hard work. I mean, I think honestly, hard work also gave me an opportunity to show my capabilities. And there are a lot of immigrants who have done the same thing. So that gave us the opportunity to succeed. And the more we succeeded, as I said, within the context of the definition of influence, as you asked, I would like to think that was why I ended up hopefully having influential positions around the world, from the U.S. to Latin America and Brazil. Many years I lived in Brazil, I lived in Argentina for a number of years, and in Africa, of course. So that's kind of how I would describe how I managed to get this unique opportunity, this wonderful opportunity as an African immigrant in the United States to end up in what I would consider to be relatively influential positions. So that's kind of a long-winded way of answering your question.
Yeah, no, we enjoy long-winded answers here on The Catalyst, and we do love them. It provides a lot of context, and I think that especially when people are beginning in their careers or just simply looking for inspiration, it's always helpful to know exactly how someone got to where they got. And I think your comment of the hard work and your immigrant story to the United States is really powerful. And as you are someone who has lived all over the world, you mentioned Brazil, but you also lived in Argentina, Saudi Arabia, and now Ethiopia. I think that in our current times, it's really important to be a global citizen. That is, someone who keeps up with what's happening in the world, but is also able to connect with a variety of people around multiple cultures. And so my next question to you is, from your experience as an expat, how did you keep balance in your life as you were just an incredibly busy man during that time? And what would you say is the most important lesson you've learned from being a global citizen?
Right, the balance part. It's important to keep things in perspective. You can't just be a monotrack or one-track minded person and expect to have a successful life. I suppose you can sacrifice everything just to be successful professionally, but if you leave out your family and your family life, your friendships and others, I think at the end of the day, once you reach that pinnacle, whatever that is, you may feel empty. So the balance word that you use, that's very important. Keep it balanced. You know, work is work, yes, whether it's your own business or you're employed by someone else, you're going up the ranks, especially in these very high-charged, competitive global companies, you need to work hard. There's no question about it. You need to sacrifice a lot of things, kids' birthdays or whatever. But at the end of the day, you got to find the right balance. Otherwise, at least my personal experience is, if we don't do that, you feel empty at the end of the day. You could have accumulated a lot of wealth. You could have acquired all the material assets. And you may have gotten a lot of publicity and other accolades and awards, but if you don't have the balance of saying, why did I work so hard, where's the contribution I made to society, where's the contribution I made to my family, taking care of, if you don't balance it, then I think the emptiness or the numbness, I think, will be there. So this balance is very important. Now, as an expat, I was an expat for many years. It was a wonderful experience. As I said, I came here as a teenager here in the United States. I'm speaking to you now today from my office here in Washington. But going overseas for the first time as an expat, it opened up my eyes to a lot of the opportunities out there. And remember, we're talking about the 90s, an expat, so it goes back a little ways, over 20 years ago, when working in emerging markets was not something that people talked about, you know? So today it might seem obvious to go work, say, in Africa or in Latin America or in Asia as emerging economies. So for someone like me to take the risk, because I was very successful here in the U.S., professionally speaking, managing large accounts with a firm, but to say I want to work emerging markets at that time seemed like a risky thing. Today, of course, you know, a lot of people who want to succeed globally actually seek out those kinds of opportunities, whether working in China or in Asia or in Africa or the Middle East. That's a sought-after opportunity. But in my case, it opened up my eyes living in Argentina, working with Latin companies, Latin American companies, and same in Brazil. It showed me leveraging, of course, the American expertise, but adapting it to the state of economic development thereat, understanding the cultural differences, appreciating and respecting it. That helped me a lot, especially later on when I start working in even lesser early stage emerging economies in Africa. I think if I had gone directly from the U.S. to Africa, for example, I think I would have had a bigger challenge. The learning curve would have been very steep, but taking that step, one step down, to go to Latin America, where their level of development, even though by many standards is very, very advanced, they're not advanced economies either. So it helped you understand what are the opportunities there, but also what are some of the challenges when you invest in emerging economies. And also understanding the different cultures, their perspective on life, their perspective on work, their perspective on a lot of things. It might be different than what we have here in the United States. So it was certainly a huge opportunity for myself personally, of course, professionally. And, you know, in the 90s, the Latin American countries were growing very rapidly. So taking American companies to invest there and helping them become successful, of course, professionally satisfied, but building the relationships. Now today I have lots of Brazilian friends, which I would never have had if I hadn't lived there. I have many Argentine friends. I have friends from neighboring countries there in Chile and Bolivia. As an African immigrant growing up in America, if I hadn't been there, if I hadn't lived there, I wouldn't have built up. Some of actually the people I met in Latin America are now co-investors with us in our fund, in the private equity firm that I'm the chairman of today. So it was an amazing both personal and professional experience. As I said, later on, it helped me also understand, again, the opportunities in Africa, but also the challenges. So this is just, I think, the big plus side. Are there challenges to living overseas? Yes. When you're new, you have to build new relationships. You have to re-prove yourself, by the way, when you go to new countries. Every 3-4 years, I was moving around. I had to build trust. And people have to say, who's this person? Is he capable? Can he adapt? To remember, I'm maybe an American, but I'm an African immigrant. Also, that element of it was always a bit of a surprise in all these countries that I worked in. And they would say, where are you from? From Africa, from Ethiopia, via the U.S. And they're saying, really? Okay. You know, it's like, are you sure you can adapt here in Latin America? You know, it's like, but that was, for me, a beautiful challenge to overcome. And ultimately, as I said, I did well, and it helped me, I suppose, build the experiences that later on also helped me succeed in Africa and in the Middle East, where we work a lot these days.
That's incredible. And it's similar to a lot of the stories and backgrounds I've heard from other guests, where it's about showing up and following opportunity and just being open to new ideas and new possibilities. And you mentioned your global private equity fund that you are chairman of, which is Fairfax Africa Fund. And you said that the fund is does both private equity and venture capital. I remember during an earlier conversation, you said that you and your firm are what you would call impact investors. And I was wondering if you could describe what an impact investor is or what impact investing is, and an example of the positive results you were able to generate through the vehicle of impact investing.
Right. You're absolutely right. We do both private equity and venture capital. The fun part is the VC, the venture capital side, for the simple reason it's pretty scary. You know, it's like guesswork, to be very frank with you. You're buying into a dream of a promoter, someone very bright. Usually, I usually probably see, 100 people, 150 people a year who pitch me ideas, right? I find the ones who are passionate, young, usually very young people, especially in Africa, who come to me and they say, Jim, you know, we have this brilliant idea to do X, Y, and Z. I love those stories. And within the first few minutes, if somebody shows passion and it seems viable, I'm always tempted to say, gee, we should go with this. But the reality is, as you probably know, as a student at Harvard, the hit rate, the success rate of VC is extremely low. Even here in the U.S., I mean, I don't know. And then when you go out further out into developing countries, it's even lower, right? Mm-hmm. But it's pretty exciting to hear those dreams, those visions, those passion. And so I love to do the VC part, but the reality is we have very few VC successes that can cover, that can return the money that the investors are putting in. So we have to do PE, okay? If given a choice, I'll do only VC, but we will never make money, enough sufficient money to recover the investor's investment. So we do private equity as well. Mm-hmm. Usually, it doesn't have to be profitable companies as long as they're up and running. They're just looking for expansion capital. We will do that as well. But the key point you raised is what I want to focus on, which is how we look at ourselves. And that is impact investors. And again, it helps me that I've lived in a lot of emerging markets and now I work in Africa, that we have to be part of the community. We have to bring real meaningful transformation to the communities, to the countries that we invest in, which means job creation, knowledge transfer, technology transfer, capacity building, empowering locals everywhere, whether it's in Ethiopia or anywhere else in Africa. Our view, and certainly it's my guiding principle, is we have to be impactful investors. We can't just be looking at IRRs on an Excel spreadsheet and say, if we achieve those, we've done our job. No. First of all, sustainability is not assured if all you're looking at is IRRs, number of IRRs. But for me, what I look at, as I said, is did we really create jobs, meaningful jobs, not these dead ends where expats do the high end and the locals do just the grunt work. No. Are we training local people? Because Africa, as you know, is a very young continent. Out of the 1.2 billion, something like 70% are under 30. Okay, I mean, I'll give you Ethiopia as an example. It's the second most populous country after Nigeria. There are 112 million Ethiopians. Something like 70% or 75% are under 30. The median age in Ethiopia is 17. So, I mean, there's a lot of talent there given the opportunity we'll deliver the kinds of results we'll find here in the U.S. or anywhere else in the world. So our view has always been, let's invest in people, young people. I mean, it's a given that, I mean, Ethiopia today, there's 45 million young people in the labor force that could be deployed into the labor force. I mean, 45 million working age people. So it's a no-brainer to invest in those kinds of people. So impactful means those kinds of things I just described. Impactful means whoever comes in and invests with us has to think long-term. See, here in the U.S., in the developed economies, you can flip assets of the PE fund every 3 to 5 years. I mean, and sometimes even less, right? It's a financial gain. Where in Africa, we expect everyone to stay in the game with us for 10 years. Okay, at least 10 years. Seven years, we might give them a soft exit, but everybody signs up for 10 years. That means this is how you become impactful. You see, cutting costs, shifting things here and there, you can show positive financial results for 2 to 3 years and you exit, but you leave nothing behind. So, again, impactful means long-term thinking, and that's what we are. And the other component of our view is we invest in things that people might never associate Africa with, which is, for example, manufacturing. It might sound like an oxymoron for people to use the word manufacturing in Africa in the same sentence, but I think it's doable. I'll give you an example, and this is something I'm the chairman of a very large Italian clothing manufacturer. And today, and it's in Ethiopia. It's a company that's very, very successful. It has 5,000 stores around the world, including here in the United States. They built their first African factory in Ethiopia a couple of years ago, less than 2 years ago, actually. And I can tell you, because they've invested in people, we've invested in people, today our productivity at the Ethiopian factory is 95% of the Italian factory, which has been around for 40 years. That means you invest in young Africans. This is why I'm saying impactful. And we pay above our average wages. And our products are now sold in D.C., in New York, and around the world, made in Ethiopia stuff. So it's not unthinkable to have manufacturing in Ethiopia or in Africa. You just have to know what you do. That's why our kind of mindset will help you succeed. Again, this company, as I said, an Italian company, just happened to be the chairman of it. But and then we even created, in less than 18 months, we've created 1,500 jobs. And then by June, we should be at 2,000 jobs. These are jobs that didn't exist a year and a half ago.
That's incredible.
Impactful. So these are the kinds of things I put in mind. I just want to be clear, though. Our PE fund doesn't have equity in that business. I just happened to be the chairman. But I'm sharing with you how I think, how my partners or companies I'm involved in, how we think about doing business in Africa. It's not just the IRRs, it's not just the cash flows or the returns or those 20% hurdles that every PE fund has put in there. As long as they exceed that, they get their bonuses. No, I want everybody to think long-term, because in the long-term, the payoff is actually substantial if you know what you do. So the answer to your question is impactful means broad, as I just described, not just the finance.
Right. That's a phenomenal feat, and especially as you mentioned, in the U.S., when it comes to investing, we're not thinking that broad of a horizon, actually. And I think Africa really does need that in terms of, as you were mentioning, creating jobs that, you know, it's not just fluff, right? And it's not just the expats that are actually doing the high-level work. And a beautiful case study of this actually is the case of Ethiopian Airlines. And this is a special case because you led the team that really helped Ethiopian Airlines become, I believe it's the second biggest airline in Africa, and generates, I believe, a revenue that's greater than all others on the continent. And could you tell us a bit about the vision, at least, that you and the team had of Ethiopian Airlines helping it become the competitor it is today? Was it something, like you were mentioning, a 10-year type of deal, a 5-year type of deal? What went into creating Ethiopian Airlines?
So obviously you've done your research, yeah? to have come up with all these. I'm happy to answer these, but I'm pleased you asked that as well. It actually shows what Africans can accomplish when our mind that we think we can, we know we can deliver big things. And Ethiopia and I are probably the best example. In fact, I've suggested to HBS, to the Harvard Business School, that they use it as a case study of an indigenous African company, 100% African owned, 100% African run, which is now amongst the largest airlines in the world. And I'll just very quickly tell you in 30 seconds, as you mentioned, what we've done, how we were involved. This was when I was running Ernst & Young. We were hired as a firm, and I pulled in a very large team. And we actually didn't even look at it, as my team at least didn't look at it as a business, to be honest. At that time, it was just a pride thing. You know, we have a lot of Africans, a lot of Ethiopians on the team, Ethiopian Americans on the team. We just said, we're going to make a difference, okay? We really didn't care what the fees were on the job. It was decent, but that was not our motivation. We said, this is a unique example where we can make a contribution. So we dedicated all our energy. We brought in very talented people. And I remember this was about 12 years ago, 13 years ago. At that time, the airline, 14 years ago, in 2015, the airline had about 1 million passengers, less than $400 million in revenue. It was so-so in terms of profitability. It's been around for about 60 years at that time, but it wasn't achieving its full potential. And that was what we were tasked with. So we came in, we gave them we worked with the airline, and they were so committed. This is the thing. They were so committed. They just said, all we need is give us a vision, give us a roadmap. The employees, the management, the board, the shareholders, they just said, just give us a vision, and we know we can deliver. So we said, okay, you're now $350 million. In 5 years, we think you could be at $1 billion. And I can tell you, there are a lot of skeptical people. Even within the airline, we said, no, these guys, they're going to get the airline. They're going to make the airline go broke. And some people retired early, saying, well, I'm going to take my pension and leave here. Here's what happened. It didn't take them 5 years to get to $1 billion. Remember, it took them 60 years to get to $350 million. In less than 4 years, they went from $350 to $100 billion, to $1 billion. Now, I forwarded 14 years later now. It's the biggest airline in Africa by far. It's bigger than South African Airways and Kenya Airways, which have the second and largest combined. It's Ethiopian Airlines is bigger. And then for the last 5 years in a row, Ethiopian Airlines has made more money than all African airlines combined. We're talking about 50, these airlines in 54 African countries combined made less money than one Ethiopian airline. This is a remarkable story.
Right.
Okay, it's one of the very few indigenous African multinationals.
Right, it's homegrown.
If you look at it, it's homegrown. Exactly, that's exactly the word you should use. Homegrown, African-run, no expats. If you come to the headquarters of Ethiopian Airlines, the entire management, the entire staff is Ethiopian, 100%. Not a single expat, from CEO to the cleaners, the gardeners, all Ethiopians or Africans. They did hire some pilots for the last few years because they were growing so fast there wasn't enough of them, but these are contractual pilots. And they're Boeing's biggest customer. This is why I'm saying earlier, impact is multifaceted. For example, Ethiopian Airlines is the biggest customer of Boeing in Africa. For every $1 billion of aircraft order by Ethiopian Airlines, 11,000 American jobs are created or retained.
Oh,
11,000.
Wow.
And Ethiopian Airlines spends billions every year buying Boeing aircraft, okay? So when we talk about impact, earlier I was giving you a different perspective. On this case, again, we work, we're very happy, we're successful. I have to give all the credit to the airline, of course. We're just the consultant, the advisors, the transaction advisors, strategic advisors. But the implementation was done, by and large, by the airline itself. And they've done a phenomenal job of delivering. And this should be a case study for Africans. Whenever anyone has doubts if Africans can create world-class institutions. You see, the rap on Africa is, we can't create world-class institutions. Well, I say, you know what? Given a chance, actually, we have companies like Ethiopian Airlines. So if you look at the annual ranking of the 200 or 300 largest companies in Africa, the first 150 or 200 are actually African subsidiaries of multinational companies, not indigenous African companies.
Mm.
Okay? We need to change that in Africa. This is what I'm talking about, impact, and that's what drives us, both as PE fund, but also as strategic advisors. By the way, at Fairfax, we have a boutique-ish investment bank, a strategic advisory firm, and this is what drives us. You know, we can make a difference, whether we work in Nigeria or Ghana. I haven't worked in Cameroon, which you said you were from originally, but I'm sure one day we'll work there. But across Africa, whenever we do projects, we do it with passion. We do say Africans can do it, can make a difference. And that's why I'm very excited about working in Africa. Our fund is exclusively focused on investments and doing business in Africa. So we don't invest in the United States. We obviously raise capital here in the U.S. We raise capital in the Middle East and in Europe and Asia, everywhere. But the only place we invest as an institution is in Africa. In my personal capacity, of course, I do my personal investment in Africa as well. But so impact, you should look at it. And Ethiopian Airlines should be really a case study at Harvard or major business schools, and especially for Africans, young Africans. As I told you, I speak at the HBS Africa Summit. I've spoken 6-7 times over the last 12 years. I always tell them it is doable. We can do it. We can do it as Africans. We just need to be given the opportunity. We just need to be given the support that we can deliver multiple Ethiopian Airlines in multiple sectors. So it's a proud achievement, not only for Ethiopia, but for across Africa. As you know, almost all airlines in Africa today are partly owned by Ethiopian Airlines. Okay? They own like 7 or 8 airlines in Africa, including the one we helped start in Togo called ASKY, which is the most successful startup airline in Africa since Africa's independence, to be honest with you. It's profitable. It's doing very well. Again, they bring in their African expertise, their global expertise. They took it to ASKY. Now they're doing with Malawi. They're doing with Mozambique Airlines. So you see, the benefit of having successful indigenous African institutions is broad. And that's what Ethiopian Airlines has demonstrated to Africa, that it is doable and that it can translate it and take that knowledge and spread it. Virtually no one wants, for example, no foreign carrier wants to invest in Africa, except for Ethiopian Airlines. Not British Airways, not United, not none of the Western carriers. They just want to carry passengers from Africa to wherever, but they're really not interested in putting money or in transferring the knowledge. Whereas Ethiopian Airlines, because of its success, because Africa is its home, has been willing to do that in 7 airlines that it owns in Africa today, partially owned, you know, 49% in most cases because of laws of national regulations. But this is why we need to make sure institutions in Africa are successful.
100%. I mean, as I was fortunate that I was raised in the United States in terms of my education, but my mother never, ever let me forget that I am Cameroonian, that I'm African first and foremost. And just hearing, you know, researching this case study in particular gave me a lot of hope, because as you've said, it shows the Western world, which I think can be a little skeptical at first, of African investment, putting money in Africa, in Africans in particular, that it's doable, that we too can create world-class institutions. So this was a very lovely case study to find out about. And, you know, not everyone is in the position to, let's say, work at an investment bank or get into finance or the like. So what advice would you give to people who are interested in Africa, who want to do something impactful on the continent, but aren't necessarily interested in finance or private equity or venture capitalism?
I'm sorry, I focused on finance and investment, but actually there's broad, a lot of things that you can engage in Africa, because the continent is wide open. I mean, it really, from entertainment to philosophers to historians, musicians, artists, and actors. I would just, you know, because of my default setting is business, that's why I was harping on that. But really, for Africans, especially Africans, those who live in the U.S. with African descent, should really look at Africa in everything that to have passion around and then go for it. There's very little limitation. I mean, challenges, plenty. But opportunities are even more challenges. So I tell people, don't let anybody discourage you from realizing your dreams. Yes, listen to advice, but stay focused, stay passionate, and I promise you, you will succeed. If all people focus on us on the risk, and hindrances, and they give you all these things about why it's not doable, whether it's here in the U.S. or in Africa. You just ignore it. As I said, I'm very fortunate. I meet thousands and thousands of people every year. You know, as you probably know, I speak at a lot of big conferences. I appear in a lot of media. So people come up to me, even whether it's in London or in New York or in D.C. or in Africa. And they, young people in particular, they say, what do you suggest I should do? I'm really interested. Or even when I come at Harvard Business School. I tell a lot of the Harvard, the HBS students, why don't you go back to Africa? Why do you want to work on Wall Street? You know, well, they say it's a lot of challenge in Africa and all that. Well, yeah, but the opportunities are there. Right. There's a lot of things you can't do in the U.S. You can do in Africa if you're focused, if you know what you do. One also thing I suggest to people is network. Network, network, network. Whatever your passion is, if you're a history major, network with people in that spectrum, in that sector. Whatever is relevant, networking is very important because people get you to places. We'll connect you to decision makers. And also, find good mentors. This has always been I succeeded because a lot of very powerful people from early on here in the United States believed in me. They gave me the opportunities, and I demonstrated my capabilities, of course, but it's good to have powerful mentors who take you under their wings and show you, because you make them look good, they'll promote you. They'll take care of you because, you deliver. So networking and mentors, seeking out mentors, absolutely. These are just, nowadays, actually, for young people like you, there's a lot more opportunity to get recognized. Social media is one of them. As you probably, even me, older folks like us now, I'm on Twitter. I get a lot of interactions with a lot of young people, a lot of people from around the world of all kinds on Twitter or DMing or something, which that opportunity never existed before. Okay, as much as I've traveled and lived around the world, my sphere would have been much more limited had it not been for the advent of technology and social media. So use that as well. I mean, like you looked me up because you saw my profile and other things. As you said, you've done research. Partly because technology made it easier. So use that as well to get recognized. If you write thoughtful things in your areas, people will pick it up, the media will pick it up, decision makers pick it up, and they give you opportunities. And then just some of the things didn't exist 25, 30 years ago. These opportunities do exist now. So it's a little bit easier, but the competition also now is much fiercer than probably when it was. There was no social media, where there was no technology as easily available as it is now.
Right, right. And in my research for this episode, I looked up an interview you did, and you were talking about investing in Africa. You said, listen, yes, the barrier of entry is low, but it moves so fast. So an opportunity that exists today is not going to exist in 5 years. And 5 years is a relatively short amount of time. So there's a sense of urgency for young people and young Africans like myself to definitely go back on the continent. And as you said, if you know what you're doing, you'll be quite successful. And you gave beautiful and really thoughtful advice about seeking mentors, going where people are able to support you and guide you along the way. And my next question to you is, how do you reach out to mentor, right? You know, you mentioned you speak a lot of conferences. What makes you want to talk to someone once they've approached you?
Listen, in my particular case, I'm open to, if I give you my normal routine, so I go give a speech at a conference, and usually people, as soon as I get off the stage, people line up and they give me my business cards, or some young people, they don't have business cards, they just catch my attention. But what the few things that they say immediately, like what it is that interested them about what I said, and how they connected to what they're doing immediately, even if it's for 5 minutes, then I give them my card, right? Or I say, follow up, DM me, or text me, or WhatsApp me. It's people who passion, people who I actually admire and I like to stay engaged with. The passion, if it shows within, the 15-second elevator pitch, well, the same thing at these events and that I see people. So stay passionate when you engage someone. I mean, people like us, we see lots of people, hundreds, thousands of people, so the attention span might be very few seconds. But if you can manage to catch up my attention or somebody like us, we're very busy, a few seconds, then it's worth it. And we also like to promote passionate people, successful people. You remember Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which is the self-actualization. I like people who self-actualize, or at least are aspiring to self-actualize. Those are the kinds of people I'm willing to dedicate whatever my time is. And I invest in people, by the way. So for me, it's natural to engage with young people. People my age, I mean, we can circulate in the same circles and we can see them, whatever. I prefer to see... I was very fortunate to have dinner with Jack Dorsey, the founder of Twitter. I had a private dinner with him. A three-hour dinner. I mean, he was an amazing, amazing guy. It was just myself and about, I think, four other people. And he was willing to spend 3 hours with us. But what he'd done was he had come to Ethiopia, and he decided that for 3 days, he only wanted to meet young people. He didn't want to meet, you know, influential business people or others. And I asked him why. And he said, that's where the future is. That's what drives him. That's what excites him. So he was spending time in incubators, you know, people who start up garage startups and mostly techies, but non-techies as well. And that's my view as well, is connect with the next generation, the younger generation, or the middle level. Not the senior executives or the chairmen of big companies. Yeah, you can connect with them and all, but where you see things going, where you connect, where you get really passionate is when you see these young people. Okay? I did a TV program similar to Shark Tank a while ago, and I remember... I had actually never followed Shark Tank until I was asked to be on this TV program. So I looked up Shark Tank, and then I went to Africa, and this program was called Lion's Den. And I saw five young people pitching, very young, 18 to 23-year-olds. And I said, this is better than any PE pitch I get from established companies, you know, in terms of the excitement and where they want to take, they are driven, they know they're going to make a difference. At least they're determined. It may not happen. That's what I like. So I connect to young people. I hire a lot of young people, of course. And so my suggestion to you and young people like you is show your passion, show your commitment, show your vision. Try to catch people's attention with a few seconds or a few minutes that you have. Talk to them about something relevant. Okay? It's not just what's in it for you, but... You tell the person, if you engage me, I will do this. I can make a difference for you kind of thing. Then you get attention from the decision maker. And that's how I operate. If I show you my Rolodex or my card scan, it has thousands and thousands of business cards and people I meet all the time, I get passionate about, but very few I get a chance to engage. And the ones that I do engage are the ones who catch my attention because of the reasons I just described.
Right. And that's wonderful advice for any young person listening to this, and also any older person listening to this. And as we're nearing the end, we're very diverse here at The Catalyst. As we're nearing the end of our interview, I think my last question, we're going to end on a bit of a personal note, is you're a very busy man, and you are running a firm that is dedicated to impact. What do you see is next for you? Are you going to continue with your impact? Do you want to create something new? Like, what are you excited about in your life in the next couple of years?
On a personal level, of course, I just got remarried, in fact, last week.
Congratulations.
So, thank you. And so that's, you know, you and I, when we talked offline before we did this interview, I was telling you my previous marriage. My wife passed away from several years of suffering from cancer. So that was a down moment, but I've been lucky and met somebody new. So on the personal note, and I have I'm a new baby. So my life is personally changed for the very significantly. That's positive to bring a new baby to this world is a big plus. My other son is about to go to college. I've been urging him to go to Harvard. he prefers California, so we'll see where he's going to end up.
Right.
So from a personal side, that those are just some of the priorities for the immediate priorities. But on the business side or the impact part of it, there's two things. One is, of course, we want to ramp up what we're doing now. We're looking to invest, certainly if things go well in the next 2-3 years, several hundred million up to $1 billion investments. We're targeting about 25,000 employees by 2025. Okay. So we're talking about portfolio companies all combined. Huh? So in many multiple African countries, that's the goal. We'll see. But as I'm getting to become a senior citizen now, I'm thinking of setting up maybe a foundation, contributing in a different kind of way. A lot of people have been urging me to write books, okay, or at least a book. So I'm seriously considering that. So things are, you know, this is the beauty of working in Africa also. In America, people nearing my age are thinking of retirement, or at least planning their retirement. In Africa, we're reinventing ourselves and the ideas and the things we want to do, because there's a lot that could be done. So I'm not anywhere near thinking of retirement. One of my friends the other day, he just retired and reminded me we're the same age. And I said, are you crazy? He said, well, you love what you do, so you can continue to go. I'm done. He said, I'm not going to stop playing golf and all that. No, not me. So you'll probably see me in the same high energy level for the next 10, 15 years. So if you and I do another interview like this in a few years, I'll still be telling you the new things that we're doing, the impact hopefully we brought into Africa, and especially my home country, Ethiopia. There's a lot of changes, a lot of positive changes going on there. So I'd like to be part of that change. So in summary, this is for the next few years, this is what my focus is going to be.
Incredible. And I'm looking forward to that future interview.
Well, listen, I would love to be back and follow up on what you've accomplished. And congratulations. As I told you, I've listened to a few of the podcasts that you've done. You're already off to a great start. And I wish you success.
Thank you so much. And thank you so much again for coming on to the podcast. I recognize that you are a very, very busy man. In fact, you're in the middle of a deal right now, so I'm truly honored.
We are. A big deal. A big deal. I'll tell you once we close it. It's a multi-billion dollar deal. Next 2-3 months, 4 months maximum, we should be able to close, and we will celebrate, hopefully, on your program.
Yes, incredible. Thank you so much again.